Welcome back to the podcast. Some of you may know that for the past few months, I've been quietly working on a tabletop RPG card game called Class Fantasy. The game is available now in a limited supply, exclusively on Metalabel. You can find a live link in the show notes on this episode. The audio that you're about to hear today is from a talk I gave at Le Commune, an art museum in Geneva, Switzerland, that recently mounted an exhibition called The Seashore of Endless Worlds, curated by Christian Billy and Samuel Wagen Mannion. The exhibition includes an incredible lineup of artists with an abundance of wall works, sculpture, and multimedia work, as well as a collection of artist games. Yes, tabletop games, board games, card games, etc. There is something about today's increasingly complex world that artists are trying to describe through gamification. This includes climate change scenarios, political simulations, and much more. In relation to my own work, it seems clear that in the last few years, gaming communities have been a hotbed for political radicalization and recruitment. Real-world extremist organizations have been founded in games like Minecraft and Roblox. All of this is an incredibly new and significant cultural phenomena that I explore in Class Fantasy. Let's get into it. Sure. Well, thank you, Samuel, for that introduction. I'm so excited to be a part of this project because there's such an amazing roster of artists involved in the show. Simon Denny, Oxalon, Crude Futures, Moving Castles, Half Earth Socialism. It's an amazing lineup of people, and I think that you've tapped into something in the zeitgeist that, is it coincidental that so many artists are working in this format of making games? Yeah, I'm super glad. Also, thank you to the curators for putting me after David Blandy, where the incredibly historically, conceptually complex games are going to be followed by my elaborate shitpost for edgelord teenagers. So hopefully there's a bit of interesting contrast here. But yeah, let me give an introduction to maybe my work. I think people will probably know me as an artist and internet culture researcher. I've spent the last few years writing about radical politics and Gen Z mimetic communities over Instagram, Discord, 4chan, Twitter, all over the internet at this point. And these online communities are now spilling over into the real world in a very serious way. So plotting that path of evolution, those emergent behaviors from collecting in online spaces organized around the signals, mostly being memes and internet content, and then devirtualizing into real world organizations, that has been kind of the arc of my work in the last few years. So also, as you mentioned, Do Not Research, which I am the founder of this arts organization, is in some ways analogous to this process that a bunch of people gathered in the Discord to discuss radical politics and memes and all of these types of things. And now it's been running for over 2 years. It's published about 200 people. We have released 2 400-page page books. That is much more than a chat room from a few years earlier. But we're here today to talk about Class Fantasy, which is a game that I've been working on for, I probably want to say that like I had been designing games with my friends since I was in middle school, high school. My own history as a gamer, I competed in arenas in World of Warcraft. At the height of my WoW career, I was globally ranked in the top 1% of PvP in arena. I grew up playing video games, RPGs, Dungeons and Dragons. I've done a bunch of that on the Twitch stream also. And spending time in that space, I noticed a pattern in the more recent research that I've been doing in the last few years about young political spaces and radical politics, that a lot of those organizations or early ideas begin, oddly enough, in the game space. So, for example, if we were to look at World of Warcraft as a political allegory, the Horde, the orcs, are literally climate refugees who have been displaced from their homeland, and they are now forced to share space with predominantly white Europeans fortified in medieval castles. The implications of some of this become rather clear. There's additionally in Warhammer, I think, is one of the most important examples in the last few years that the lore of the game, if you're not familiar, is kind of a parody of dictatorship. In one of the more recent updates a few years ago, there were gender-neutral pronouns introduced for the Adeptus Mechanicus, which is a race of robotic people. They don't necessarily have genders. They're all like a kind of hive mind robot race. And some people in the Warhammer community became very upset that Warhammer had gone woke and so on and so forth. But all of these places, to me, when I look at how people experiment with organizing societies in the game space, you can read them as, oh, Stormwind from World of Warcraft is a theocratic monarchy. The druids live very differently. The druids live as kind of nomadic bands of hunter-gatherers. The druids are anarcho-primitivists. You have all sorts of examples of civic nationalists. You have revanchist factions. You have mercenary bands. There's a kind of gradation of different political ideologies that are experimented with in the game space. And for me, when I was reading in the last few years, I felt like the mainstream media coverage of these topics would always attribute political radicalism to the demographic composition of the gamers, that these were, I mean, quite clearly, predominantly middle-class white men. These are the subjects that would be amenable to far-right ideas. And because of their the demographic compositions of those communities, that's why so many gamers, you know, a la Gamergate and all of these other cultural phenomena, went really deep into right-wing ideas in the last few years. For me, that explains a certain portion of it, but I felt that it was largely insufficient because, in my understanding, the game space is a place of withholding your disbelief. It's a space to experiment with new ideas of organizing society. And as a young person, you know, as a middle schooler playing Dungeons and Dragons, when I would encounter this moment of the character selection screen or the role-playing character sheet, this is a moment for me to think about whether I identify with a paladin who is lawful good, who upholds the law of the land, a police officer in the modern day allegory, the modern day analogy, or do I identify with a rogue who's an outlaw, who is chaotic good or chaotic neutral and does not abide by the law? Through that lens, the conventional Dungeons and Dragons political alignment grid of people will be familiar, the lawful good, lawful neutral, lawful evil, so on and so forth. You see these meme overlays that are very common in different places online. The idea for a young person that in alignment of lawful evil, the idea that the current way of organizing society could be morally or ethically wrong, that that power should be confronted, perhaps overthrown, that is a pretty radical kernel of an idea to put into the mind of a young person. So my approach to this stuff has always been that game spaces are far more complicated than we give them credit for. And those are the things that I wanted to bring to the forefront with class fantasy. Okay, so class fantasy on its own is a action RPG role-playing game. It involves 12 core characters. Within the game, there are very clear dynamics between characters that have a measurable advantage over their opponent. Samuel has it on the screen here. You've got the box version. I have my other. Mine is a little bit more outdated, actually. I have an earlier playtest version, but I'm quite happy with the box. And emblazoned on the box itself and the back of the cards is the D&D alignment grid of your chaotic good, chaotic neutral, chaotic evil, and so on, overlaid with the political compass of the x-axis between left and right and the y-axis between authoritarian and libertarian. And so this image actually circulates in many different versions that percolates through the memesphere, where many people, aside from just me, have made this connection that role-playing games are very similar to the political compass, and you can slot people into these different alignments. So the game itself does exactly that with the 12 different characters. And these are roughly mapped to the conventional classes that you would encounter in World of Warcraft or Dungeons and Dragons and so on, all of these different games. My favorite, because I hate this political ideology and they're the most fun to make fun of, the thief in the traditional Dungeons and Dragons game is here mapped to the anarcho-capitalist. The wizard is a libertarian, the warlock is a techno-feudalist, the druid is obviously the anarcho-primitivist, the crusader is an eco-fascist. There's a variety, I'll run through some of these a bit more expediently for time. We have the civic nationalist, we have anarcho-communism, social democracy, paleoconservatism, market socialism, state socialism, and primitive communism. So 12 different classes, each of which has a unique stat for health points, a different armor class, all of the conventional things that you would find on a character sheet. And they have a few entertaining abilities. Social democracy's main ability is called labor strike. The anarcho-primitivist has an ability called touch grass, which allows him to heal over time. The anarcho-communist has an ability called please educate yourself, which will deal massive damage to his opponent, but will also deal reflexive damage to himself. There's a variety of different abilities in this. The libertarian's main ability is called, well, actually, of course. And each of these classes has a pretty unique playstyle that's pretty individual to them. So the techno-feudalist has a clear logistical rotation, high degree of complexity, keeping track of different tallies, balancing where all of your output and your stat allocation is placed in each different turn. And then conversely, a character like the anarcho-primitivist is really designed to outlast every other character in the game. That he has the most duration, but he has the least effective burst, that he's not able to put out a lot of throughput in a confined situation, but he will be able to extend the game for a very long period of time. So this was modeled off of the initial literal political debates between teenagers that I would watch on Instagram kind of every night. Like, that became my practice for a few months or a few years. And I would see an anarcho-capitalist debate an anarcho-communist, and then I would see a mutualist debate a national capitalist, and so on and so forth. And the eventual point at which these debates resolved is that in the debate format, eventually anarcho-primitivism would out-debate everyone. Because all societies, if they create a utopia, you have your civic nationalist utopia or your paleo-conservative utopia, those things all have a built-in time frame where they may last for 50 years, they may last for 100 years, but anarcho-primitivism lasts for thousands of years, if not millennia. It is the beginning before human civilization, and it is the end. So the longer you can stretch out the game, the more likely anarcho-primitivism is to win. So without belaboring this too much, we'll get into some of the alignments and the mechanics of the game, but certain ideologies synergize with other players. So in the example of a 1v1 game, that is not necessarily the ideal scale at which to play class fantasy. The metagame really involves stacking different political alignments and team building, because there are bonuses that, for example, the civic nationalist, the civil libertarian, or the state socialist will not be able to unlock for themselves. They need to apply those bonuses to other characters, and then different synergies will unlock, and in some cases, multiply. So intentionally built into the game are countercomps. Eco-fascism is extremely vulnerable to anarcho-communism. Anarcho-capitalism is able to beat techno-feudalism, sheerly just outcompete techno-feudalism, but market socialism will give you all the dynamism of the market, and it is a strong countercomp to anarcho-capitalism, literally immobilizing their opponent in this case. Various forms of complexity built into it, different countercomps that make the 1v1 experience, in some cases, very one-sided. So the point of the game then becomes to build a political coalition of people who have synergizing abilities and to anticipate all of the moves that your opponent is going to make, be able to have a counter for them, and so on. So yeah, we'll get into the game here where you have team play, which is rather straightforward, where I'll construct a team that consists of eco-fascism and state socialism. You can also pick and choose, put players together a la carte. And you have this 3v3 team battle situation, very clear win conditions for everybody. In various, I believe some of the playtests that we did in the exhibition in Geneva, we got really, really close results. And in some of my own playtesting, it can come down to a single move that determines the game, can be very balanced. In some cases, it can come down to single-digit health points that determine the game. The alliances between players are not determined by chosen teams in advance. Instead, you are in alliances based on your political alignment. So if you are, for example, the anarcho-communist and you're in the lower left corner, you're in the libertarian left corner, you also happen to be at the bottom of the alignment grid at chaotic good. So you're on the far left axis and then the bottom axis. So you have potential alignments with characters all the way up the y-axis in the good alignment. So you can be allied with social democracy, primitive communism, or state socialism. Additionally, you have characters across the chaotic alignment, so you can have alliances with anarcho-primitivism, civil libertarian, and anarcho-capitalism. And at different moments in the game, those alignments may flip. Each player is playing for themselves to achieve their own utopia, which is the maximum way to achieve points in the game, where you are the only surviving political ideology. And to do that, you need to build these temporary alliances with the other players to ensure your own survival. So, for example, you could have a block of authoritarian players and then a scattering of other players. What will frequently happen is that you'll eliminate a character that could have multiple alliances. They're just too well positioned. Everybody will gang up on this one player who's very strong. What will happen following that is that players will seek to reduce the competition by ganging up on the next person who's very well positioned, but they will often choose not to eliminate this player because it is more effective to leave that player in the game to deal damage to your opponents, but have them so low on life that you could choose to eliminate them at any moment. And so this, for me, is an analogy to how political coalitions and conflict work in the real world, in that it doesn't matter what we try to convince people, you know, the ideas in their head of whether they see a situation through lens A or lens B. It only really matters what effect they can have in the real world, if it's worth keeping them around to attack your opponent. And you actually see that dynamic play out a lot in this game. Class fantasy is a gamified model of agonistic political conflict. It is not a traditional role-playing game. There's no debate. There's no language exchange between the players. It is all duked out through combat. So that was my addition to the role-playing discourse here. The way that I achieved this was by creating an elaborate pricing system to figure out how much one point of healing is worth. Is it worth a point of armor? Is it worth a point of mitigation or throughput? Or is, for example, is a point of healing worth more than a point of damage because healing needs to be done in response to damage? So this created a kind of system of shadow pricing, which is my obsession over the last few years of creating the perfect planned economy. I'm even finding that in the game space. And it has, I think, successfully now, we've had some pretty successful tests with it where I have effectively balanced those things for, you know, within a few points of each other, sometimes single digits. So that's very exciting. Yeah, this seems to have been demonstrated in the first round of playtesting that we did. We'll do a follow-up round of playtesting in New York. I've published books and podcasts and a number of other artworks and things, but I have not yet published a game. This is the first time I've designed it, but I think in a way, the response to this, you know, in advance, I see people lining up these ideas and bridging the kind of conceptual through point on the whole project. So yeah, mapping political ideologies, understanding the game space, understanding the different dynamics that play out in political conflict, all of that is kind of comedically mapped within this game. So the 12 classes and the entire game is about 80 cards right now. So yeah, it comes in a cardboard box with the custom print, and even the final design for the cards is a little bit more complex than the playtesting version we had. Very excited to get that out. And I have many more things to say and things to go over in my notes, but maybe I'll give Christian and Samuel a chance to chime in here. And in the few remaining minutes we have, I can answer a question or two if that's helpful. Yeah, probably it's an interesting exercise, and I would say that probably my own idea of my alignment has gone from chaotic good to neutral good in the last few years. So yeah, it's an interesting historical moment. I guess I would say that, and I'll be conscious of our time here, but the simplification of the political compass, I understand it's obviously a very reductive idea. I think it gets at one important idea that within both the left and right, there are meaningful disputes between, for example, socialists and anarchists, and also on the right, populists and libertarians. So having one additional degree of resolution beyond the left-right binary is sometimes very helpful in elucidating what the internal conflicts are of a certain position. So yeah, the grid becomes a very useful system in that sense. So obviously, reducing things down to a two-dimensional map reduces their complexity and all these sorts of things. But I also want to I want to push back on that a little bit, because I think there's an alternative way of understanding that, in that to understand things and to calculate all of their potential outcomes, we need to necessarily reduce their complexity to create different pathways, a cone of possibilities in what is the maximum outcome, what is the minimum outcome, and what is everything in between. And so when I was designing this game, I had initially incorporated something that was similar to Magic the Gathering, where there were different mana costs, where you could pay, you know, 1 point of mana for this and 2 points of mana for that and so on. And there's all of these different possibilities you have in your turn. And then I thought, like, you know, the world's most complex game is chess. And chess, you get one single move. And that is actually the core of the complexity of the game, in that there's so many different possibilities, but you are restricted to one. So having those rigorous restrictions on the total amount of moves that you can do, when I started to build Class Fantasy, having one action point per turn, rather than having different mana costs and, you know, maybe two different possibilities or four different possibilities, or they start to multiply, 16 different possibilities of what you could do that turn. When I restricted it to one, what it required was that players made turns planned many multiple turns in advance, that if I vanish on this turn, then I know I'm going to get hit with an AoE damage thing the next turn, and that will invalidate my move. And you have to think like two or three steps ahead. And so having those requirements of reducing the complexity, fixing people to one decision at a time, made everything extremely, extremely meaningful. And the result of that was one misstep could mean your elimination from the game. You know, and so actually it increased the drama, it increased the dynamism, it increased the stakes. You know, not to overly simplify the real world, we should not do that with political conflict or our ideology, and I'm very pro-complexity, which is why I speak for hours and hours on a podcast. But in terms of systems modeling, I think there are unique moments where actually reducing the complexity allows you to do much more meaningful calculations and to extrapolate for more potential possibilities in the future, you know? Yeah. Okay. So that's, I realize we're getting short on time, and Arthur from Trust, actually, I'm going to stick on the call because I really want to hear about Arthur's game. So yeah, this has been great. Thank you, Christian. Thank you, Samuel. Head over heels, just very happy with the exhibition. And yeah, thanks so much for everything. Thank you for listening. Grateful for your support. You can find a link in the show notes for this episode. I'm excited for you all to play Class Fantasy.